Today on Against the Grain, veterans are a prominent symbol in U.S. politics, evoking patriotism and military might. The right recruits them, and they populate the police, private security, and often militia groups. But the struggles of veterans and those currently working for the military should be of concern for the left, argue Suzanne Gordon and Steve Early. They discuss the always non-union labor of military work, as well as attempts to privatize veterans' healthcare, and the political orientation of veterans and the organizations claiming to represent them. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When we think about workers, we don't tend to think about those employed by the military, in active duty, or as veterans. But my guests today say that's a mistake, part of a blind spot on the left about the working conditions, health care, and civilian afterlives of those employed by the Department of Defense. In Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs, Suzanne Gordon, Steve Early, and Jasper Craven challenge us to take a different look at the situation of those in the military. Gordon is an award-winning journalist and author, while Early is a writer, organizer, union representative, and labor activist. Suzanne, there's a question that needs to be asked right off the bat. There are some on the left who are quite uncomfortable with veterans issues, since it feels like focusing on veterans is some way being soft on imperialism. And undoubtedly, veterans are constantly evoked by the right in the service of military power. You both have long histories in the anti-war movement. Why should we care about veterans and labor?
Veterans are not the cause of militarism and imperialism. They're the victims of it often. And I mean, obviously, if you're a general, that's sort of different, but the majority of veterans are not the officer class. And so to suggest that they're the problem is, I think, misguided, one. And then B, you know, they're part of the broader community. And whether we like the military or not, the reality is that these people think they're serving us. They are sacrificing, and we have a responsibility to take care of them and attend to their problems. And then the third reason, I think, is if we don't approach veterans with progressive ideas, and they are not a monolith. I mean, there's many veterans groups that are very progressive, but if we don't approach people with progressive ideas, then you're ceding the ground to the right. And I think that's what's happening now. And that I think is a tremendous mistake.
Steve, following the Vietnam War, there was a very consequential shift from conscription of the general public, or the male general public, to an all-volunteer army. What drove that shift, and what are the consequences for it? What incentive does anyone have now to sign up for the military?
The U.S. military spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on recruiting. You know, there's recruiting stations, storefronts, and small cities and towns and big cities throughout the country, thousands of places where you can go and sign up to become a member of the armed forces. And that recruiting effort has been necessary for the last 45 years because of what you just mentioned, the shift from what had been an army created with the help of the draft, of conscription. The hundreds of thousands of soldiers who were in the military during the Vietnam era were, for the most part, draftees or enlisted people who very often enlisted under the pressure of the draft. What the military learned from the Vietnam experience was that a draftee army can become very political. It can become very unruly. It can become very restive. And one of the hidden histories of the Vietnam War was the really important role that the GI anti-war movement played in bringing that war to a conclusion. It's well documented, a number of books have been written about it, but the network of dissident soldiers, both here and abroad, that developed in the late 60s and early 70s, really created a lot of problems for the U.S. military leadership, the political leadership. And as the Vietnam War wound down, policymakers decided we need a different kind of army to fight these kinds of wars. And it's going to be a so-called all-volunteer army. It's going to be a professional military. And we're going to increase and improve the recruiting incentives, the benefits. We're going to make this appear to be more of a career. And we're going to get away from a situation where we have a lot of unwilling recruits who end up being political dissenters and causing disruption within our ranks.
What has that done in terms of fostering a divide between people who are in the military or who are veterans and the rest of the population?
Well, I think as we show in the book, there were certainly a lot of inequities during the draft era. I was the beneficiary of a student deferment between 1967 and 1971 that helped keep me from being drafted and sent to Vietnam or someplace else. But there was a broader cross-section of the population drawn into the military in the era of the 20th century citizen armies, certainly the army that was mobilized to fight in World War II. What's changed since the so-called all-volunteer army was launched really is the composition both of the active duty forces and then, of course, the veteran population. We're now down to about 7% of the adult population ever having served in the military, which is kind of an all-time low. Many of the post-9/11 military recruits have been drawn from economically distressed, non-white urban communities. Many of them come from multi-generational military families, usually concentrated in rural red states or near Sunbelt military bases. What this means is that fewer and fewer people today, unlike in the 1950s or 60s or 70s, have any connection with anybody in the military. There's no one any longer in many families who've ever served. People don't have anybody in their circle of friends or even their neighbors who ever served in the military because of this class and geographical skewering of the base for military service in this country. So this has led to an increasingly pronounced divide and cultural gap between those in the military who've been in the military and the 93% of us in the adult population who have not.
It's also just created a huge amount of resentment in the volunteer military of the people. You know, they feel they sacrificed, nobody else has sacrificed. And so there's an enormous amount of disenchantment and resentment within the ranks of the active duty service and veteran community.
Yeah, and we'll return to some of the implications for working class politics, for the left of that divide and those sort of resentments. But Suzanne Gordon, I wanted to ask you about the kind of incentives people have to sign up for an all-volunteer professional army at this point. What do they get if they participate in the military?
If you want to see the kind of propaganda in action, you can go to Go Army. I mean, obviously, that's just one branch of the service, the Army. We use the term sometimes Army and soldier to mean the whole shebang. I mean, when in fact that's just one branch of the service. But I think it's very clear that in this era of the all-volunteer military, it's very, there's a certain cohort that's recruited on the basis of let's go over there and, you know, beat them down. But I think a lot of people join up because of the benefits, because they get a free education theoretically, they get free healthcare theoretically. They got a lot of benefits when they are in the service. They get, you know, free housing and clothing and food and pensions. They have better pensions. I mean, the salaries are ludicrously low, but it's very stable, and it's very clear. The hierarchy is very clear. People feel a sense of purpose, but for progressives and the left, it's really important to understand that the promise of a free education and the promise of free healthcare when you're finished leads a lot of people to go into the military. And this is important to understand because if the country ever took seriously Medicare for all or any form of universal health coverage, the military would have a total freak out because they would lose one of their two biggest pillars for recruitment and ditto free education. So I don't think people get it. You know, this is a real problem. What I think it's Jennifer Mittelstadt calls this the military social welfare state. And they're very clear that this is their, these are their biggest recruitment tools.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds positively socialistic, which is an interesting contradiction given all the ideology around the military. Suzanne, can you remind us of the Veterans Administration or VA system of healthcare and why it's so unusual in the United States, something you've written a lot about?
Yeah, so the VA stands for the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's the either second or third largest after the Pentagon agency in the federal government. And it has three primary sub-agencies, the Veteran Benefit Administration that oversees things like the GI Bill and home loans and various other benefits and is the gateway to the Veterans Health Administration, which is the largest publicly funded, fully integrated healthcare system in the country. And, you know, it's interesting because we all see the signs, VA hospital exit here off the highway, but very few people understand what goes on there. And it's a really discharge to grave system, serves 9 million veterans. There's a lot of Byzantine eligibility requirements. Not all veterans can get in if they have the wrong discharge, which is a very fascinating subject in itself. They can't get VA benefits, either education or health. And then you have to have a service-connected disability or a low enough income. But the Veterans Health Administration, or VA healthcare, serves about 9 million veterans. And it is actually probably, I would argue, the best healthcare system in the United States. Its outcomes are stunningly better than the private sector in a lot of areas. And it's really the only healthcare system that's concerned with healthcare equity, with what we call social determinants of health. And it's quite remarkable at its best. And it's because it's so remarkable that there's this huge right-wing effort led by the Koch brothers, now brother-funded Concerned Veterans for America, to kill the VA and privatize it.
And just to be clear, the VA is different even than a system that one would imagine with Medicare for All, because it actually provides the services as a sort of socialized entity. Can you explain that dimension?
Medicare for All and single payer is about the payer, not the provider of services. Now, there's efforts to, you know, have improved Medicare for All and so forth, but Medicare is not a provider, it's a payer. And it makes rules about what it will pay for and tries to impact practice through that, but the VA is a payer and a provider. So everybody in the VA system is on salary, which is really different from the private sector system where most of it's fee for service and like 50% of doctors are private contractors, you know. And so there's no incentive to over-treat or under-treat in the VA. And it's really mission-driven, not profit-driven, as the private sector system is. It's quite remarkable. And it also does what the private sector system doesn't do, which is actually coordinate care. And that doesn't just mean that people have a shared medical record, which they do. The VA has the best medical record, electronic medical record, one of the first and the best in the country, although they're trying to mess it up. But it also, people actually coordinate care by actually talking to one another, which is a stunning and amazing revolution in healthcare, because most private sector providers, you know, never talk to each other about complex cases. So you get real care coordination and team-based care in the VA.
And we'll return to the question of the VA as we go and the attempts to privatize it. I'm speaking with Suzanne Gordon. She's an award-winning journalist and author, and she is the co-author with my other guest, Steve Early, and also Jasper Craven, of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. And that's forthcoming from Duke University Press. I'm also joined by Steve Early, writer, organizer, union representative, and labor activist. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So, Steve, I wanted to ask you about a concept which I think is strange for us, even on the left, which is about the idea of military service as a form of work. We don't tend to think of the military as a workplace, but among other things, you argue that that's what it is. Can you discuss the working conditions that members of the military face?
Well, a major focus of our book really is documenting the wide range of hazards, occupational health and safety problems that members of the military encounter in the course of their service. And obviously, people think you're in the military, you're a soldier of some sort, you're fighting in a war, you're in a combat zone, obviously got to be dangerous. As we show in the book, the number of people who serve in those kinds of situations is really a minority of all the people in the military, and a much broader range of the military workforce is exposed to hazards that are eminently avoidable if they had a better employer than the U.S. Department of Defense. Some of these workplace hazards have been getting quite a bit of attention in the press lately. One of the biggest that's being hotly debated at the moment in terms of legislative solutions is the exposure of an estimated 3.5 million men and women who've served mainly in the Middle East over the last 30 years who've been exposed to toxic burn pits. It's now become pretty widely understood that when you burn piles of toxic junk on or near a military base, it has a really bad impact on the long-term health of people who are serving nearby. So burn pits is one issue, but as we also point out in the book, there's the historic legacy of Agent Orange exposure for Vietnam veterans, exposure to the toxic herbicide that was manufactured by Dow Chemical and sprayed in large quantities over South Vietnam. There are, in the post 9/11 wars, a lot of veterans who've lost their hearing as a result of inadequate hearing protection. Others who suffered traumatic brain injuries because of defective helmets. What we document really is that being an employee of the Department of Defense is quite dangerous, even if you never leave the country, never fire a shot in an actual war. And that's because soldiers, sadly, have no rights equivalent to workers in the private sector or in the public sector, civilians. They don't have unions. They don't have the same regulatory protections. So this is something that more young people and their families really need to check out before they enlist, because 4 years in the military can sometimes have a lasting and deleterious impact on people's mental and physical health.
What about conditions for women in the military? Women make up a growing percentage of people in the U.S. military.
Oh, the situation for women is very dire. Disabled American Veterans, the DAV, did several very important reports on this. And I think it was 60 to 70% of women who they surveyed reported that the military, being in the military, was not good for them. And I mean, one of the most notable problems is military sexual trauma. A huge percentage of women who've served in the military have encountered this spectrum of problems that goes from everything from harassment to assault to rape. And tragically, many women who report the problem find that the process of reporting was worse than the event. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the old debates about rape. And many times women who report a rape or an assault of some kind find that they get what is called an other than honorable discharge. They're essentially punished by being what's called sort of chaptered out of this whatever service they're in, and then they get denied VA benefits because if you have an other than honorable discharge, you can't get education benefits, you can't get any VA benefits, including health care. But women also have a lot of reproductive problems because of being in the military. I mean, anything that a male service member suffers, they're going to suffer, but then there's the added issue of, you know, reproductive problems and so forth. There's more divorce. There's a lot of intimate partner violence in the military, an astonishing amount. This gets almost no press at all, which also happens and carries over into the veteran community. So there's a growing number of women in the military, but there's a lot that could be done and that isn't being done. I think Steve can perhaps add to this about the legislation that they've tried to pass about to rein in the problem, which has been opposed by, I believe it is General Austin.
There's been some legislation passed recently that I think basically has been a disappointment, certainly to Senator Gillibrand from New York, who is its main sponsor. The chain of command continues to have too much control over how these cases are investigated. Until there's fundamental reform, people are going to still be very vulnerable and file complaints, not have them followed up, not have them properly investigated, and have terrible instances of misconduct, actual criminal behavior, covered up.
Suzanne Gordon, can you remind us how time in the military affects veterans when they return to the workplace as civilians? How is it different for former officers as opposed to enlisted personnel?
Well, I think that the one of the things that we really tried to show in our book is how military indoctrination, which is what it's called by the military, reshapes you. And it creates very black and white thinking. It creates a lot of divides between the civilian population and the military population, because people in the civilian population are constructed very deliberately as sort of wusses and weak, and it's very misogynist. That was another thing that I failed to mention when I was talking about women in the military, is that they end up in a deeply misogynist culture. And so there's a lot of indoctrination because, you know, fundamentally, I mean, it's interesting because when we talk in the book later about the effort to recruit service candidates, there's this whole thing about, oh, these people will be more bipartisan, you know, they're mission driven, they have somehow experience in international relations because they once went to serve bashing down doors in Iraq. But the fundamental thing that we remind people is the military is not the Peace Corps, and it the fundamental indoctrination is to teach people how to kill people, which is a very tricky thing because you're taught not to kill people and then you have to teach people to kill people. And it's very hierarchical, the military, very hierarchical. Obviously. And so there's a big distinction in the military between the officer class and the rest of everybody, you know, the grunts, as it were. And that distinction plays out later in what happens to veterans when they leave the service, because it's the service is class-based, and that those class biases follow people, so that, you know, the military advertises itself as like, be all you can be, you know, get any job you want. Well, that may be true for the officer class, you know, the folks who went to West Point or whatever, but it ain't true for the rest of the people who form the bulk of the armed services, and they end up in often working class jobs. Now, that's not to say that there aren't opportunities that are opened up to people. There are. But the opportunities are not necessarily spread evenly across the socioeconomic spectrum. And why we believe that myth is sort of beyond me. But that's a myth that prevails and that we try to really explore, you know, what happens to folks based on the officer, on whether they were officers or not. And the people who've done the best, you know, were the highest ranking folks.
Steve Early, quite a few of the enlisted personnel find themselves in what you describe as a vet to cop pipeline, working for the police or for private security firms. Can you tell us about that process and how they end up there?
Yes, a lot of folks that come out of the military end up in the public sector. Law enforcement is the third most common occupation after going to work for the VA, which about a third of the workforce serving other veterans in the VA healthcare system are former members of the military themselves. The post office is another big employer of veterans, about 100,000 veterans work for the Postal Service, but the law enforcement situation is a little more problematic, as we point out in the book. First of all, you end up with a disproportionate number of former military people in local police departments. Close to 20% of all law enforcement personnel have some kind of military background. And you know, it's been widely noted, certainly since the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer of 2020, that there is a Pentagon-to-police pipeline of equipment that has added to a militarized policing approach, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of cast-off military equipment. You know, has been turned over to local police departments, and we saw some of that gear on display in parts of the country when people protested police brutality as part of the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. But adding to that problem is that we have many people trading one uniform for another, and a number of academic studies have been done, one by police chiefs themselves, one by the Marshall Project, which kind of confirm, and as we show in the book, that this is often not a good career choice for people who've had, particularly someone who's had a bad experience in the military. It tends to reinforce a militarized approach to policing. People who've come back from patrolling occupied cities and towns in a country like Iraq or Afghanistan over the last 20 years ends up often with a mindset as a police officer back here at home that really isn't conducive to police reform, to say the least, or a community policing approach. And so what we point out in the book is that there needs to be much closer screening, really, of people coming out of the military, going into law enforcement. Veterans get preferences in hiring, which help them get jobs as cops. And that is often an impediment, as we point out, to diversification of police forces, to the extent that people believe that that is an important reform goal. It's harder to get women, people of color, people from non-military backgrounds into police departments if you have veteran preferences. And the Department of Defense encouraging so many soldiers leaving the military to go into law enforcement.
And it's also not good necessarily for particular veterans. I mean, if you have PTSD, going from one so-called combat zone to another is not very helpful. I mean, I interviewed a guy in Hawaii who was a deputy sheriff and had several residential hospitalizations for PTSD and was finally told by his VA psychiatrist that if he wanted to maintain his family, he should change jobs. And they gave him money through VA's vocational rehabilitation program to learn a new trade in construction, and he was a lot better off. So, I mean, there's a lot of, as one of our sources who was in the military himself pointed out, you know, sometimes these career counselors, instead of asking somebody, what would you like to do? What would you be interested in? They often channel people into being a police officer or a private security because that's an easy option. And that may not be the best option for the veteran or for the community.
Suzanne Gordon and Steve Early are my guests. They are co-authors with Jasper Craven of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. Suzanne Gordon is an award-winning journalist, and Steve Early. Many books include Refinery Town and Save Our Unions. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Steve, there are various veteran service organizations that promote the interests of veterans, or at least promote their ostensible interests. Who are they, old and new, and what do you make of their efforts, if you can generalize?
Well, we have a couple of chapters on what we call the new and old veteran service organizations. The old ones, I think, are pretty familiar to most Americans. Everybody's seen a local post of the American Legion or the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Those two well-known organizations are part of a constellation of traditional veterans advocacy groups known inside the Beltway as the Big Six. And, for many years, they wielded considerable influence, some of it very positive, as an advocate for veterans and their families. And one of these groups, the Vietnam Veterans of America, for example, has been in the forefront of the fight over four decades for compensation and benefits for Vietnam-era veterans who suffered from exposure to Agent Orange. So in the book, you know, we liken the role of the traditional veterans organizations to that of organized labor, to the extent that a lot of their day-to-day work involves individual service provision, helping former members of the military file VA disability claims, help them navigate the whole appeals process if they have a contested claim, help them get hooked up to GI Bill benefits so they can go back to school at government expense, help them find jobs. So the functioning of these online organizations is very much like that of a traditional union. The newer veterans organizations are less membership-based. They don't really have elected leadership. They're more staff-run. And they're even more dependent than the old-line groups on corporate funding, which is very problematic in terms of the stance that some have taken on issues like the threat of privatization of veterans' health care.
Steve, you write about the parallel decline of organizations for veterans like the kind you're describing that are membership-based and trade unions. Why do you think they've declined in tandem?
Well, I think it's partly a generational thing. The older veterans organizations tended to be more popular among an older generation of veterans, as veterans of World War II, Korean War, and now Vietnam die off. The ranks of the veterans of foreign wars, the American Legion, Vietnam Veterans of America have shrunk. And post 9/11 veterans, as we've shown in the book, some of them are active members of these old-line groups, but many have joined none of them, or they've gravitated towards this new cohort of organizational players in the field of veterans affairs, some of which do provide essential services, some of which have actually played a positive role in lobbying against forever wars and opposing militarism, but others of which, as I mentioned earlier, have not been very helpful in mobilizing veterans to defend what Suzanne described earlier, which is this island of socialized medicine in the U.S., the veterans' healthcare system.
Yeah, and Suzanne, let me ask you about that further. You had mentioned that there are attempts to partially privatize the Veterans Health Administration. I wanted to ask you about those efforts and how you see veterans organizations responding or not responding to those efforts.
You know, tragically, since about 211, you know, there's been a huge effort on the part of the Kochs and the hospital industry and so forth to get their hands on the, you know, 80, 90, whatever billion dollar pot of gold that goes to public sector provision of healthcare through the Veterans Health Administration. And various players, including the healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical industry, want that money. The VA negotiates drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry and gets lower prices. So they would love to see that disappear. You know, the hospital industry would love for veterans who need hip replacements or colonoscopies to come to their facilities so they could do these high-end, costly procedures and recommend even more of them that may not even be necessary. They don't want to deal with chronic mental illness or chronic health conditions that veterans have, but they want the expensive, fragmented, episodic treatments. And tragically, they have manufactured scandals out of problems and sensationalized problems and really used any little glitch, big or little, some have been big, but some are little. In the VA, they have very successfully managed a media campaign to influence even the mainstream media against the VA, the New York Times being a prime example, constantly running this narrative that their VA is pretty much broken beyond repair. And they have spent millions of dollars a year to do this. And they have sponsored bills, like the most recent was the VA Mission Act of 2018, which dramatically accelerated outsourcing veteran care to the private sector, regardless of the cost or the quality of the care that's being provided. And there's a section of this law called the Asset and Infrastructure Review Commission, which sets up a commission of 9 members, none of whom have any experience with assets and infrastructure. And it was designed by Trump. This was a Trump-era law designed to really cripple the VA by outsourcing and also by conducting a so-called analysis of VA infrastructure and deciding what to close and what to fix. And tragically, the traditional VSOs and the new ones, including Iraq and Afghanistan, Veterans America, the Legion, the VFW, they all lobbied Congress for this Trump-era law. There were some things in it that they wanted that were good and that could have been separated out into different legislation, but no, they went for it. And they convinced all but 5 folks in the Senate and 79 people in the House to vote for this terrible bill. And now we are reaping what they sowed. And there is now a proposal by the VA Secretary Dennis McDonough, who has continued to implement this Trump-era process rather than try to reverse it. And there are proposals to shut down VA facilities all across the country, many in rural underserved areas. He has a very ambitious construction project or proposed construction project, but no funds have been allocated by Congress. And there's no real plan in his proposal to deal with that problem. And so it's very disturbing. And thankfully, some of the members of Congress who voted for this terrible law, including many Republicans, are now up in arms about, oh, you can't close my VA. But we don't really know what's going to happen. The process just really is revving up. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
Steve, Suzanne at the beginning of the program mentioned when she was talking about why the general public should care about veterans issues. Among other things, she talked about how they are a target of recruitment by the right. And I wanted to ask you further about that. The support of veterans is a prize, obviously, by politicians posturing about the military. And veterans are a regular symbolic feature in U.S. elections. And Trump was particularly effective in appealing to veterans. Why do you think that was, and what larger implications do you think there are for the left of the right's attempt to appeal to veterans and veteran support for the right?
Well, I think what needs to happen to counter this pretty active recruitment by the Republican Party, by right-wing militia groups, by kinds of groups that brought a disproportionate number of veterans to the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The one antidote to this unhealthy trend is the labor movement. About 1 million veterans are employed in union jobs. And as I mentioned earlier, a couple of unions, the American Federation of Government Employees, which represents more than 300,000 people at the VA, the various postal unions, which have 100,000 members who are veterans, and many private sector unions, which have a lot of veterans in their ranks, the building trades, my own union, the Communication Workers of America, they all need to be doing much more internal education and organizing work with their own members who have this dual identity of being both a dues-paying trade unionist and a former member of the military. CWA actually has one of the most interesting programs. It's called a Veterans for Social Change program. And CWA has worked in partnership with Common Defense, which is a post 9/11 progressive veterans organization that has campaigned against forever wars and against corporate domination of politics and tried to run some progressive veterans for public office. Common Defense and CWA have worked together to bring union members with military experience to veterans organizing institutes around the country, where they've learned new skills as workplace and political organizers. Members of this CWA network, along with members from other unions, were very effective, I think, in the 2020 election in talking to their coworkers, talking to fellow members of veterans organizations about why voting for Trump and the Republicans was not in the best interests of either the labor movement or veterans. So I think that's an important resource that the labor movement needs to utilize a lot more as a potential counterweight to right-wing recruitment of veterans.
Do veterans tend to associate with the right politically or self-identify with the right, or is this something that changes with time historically? I mean, obviously, the stereotype is that people who have been in the military are likely to support policies that are pro-militarist.
The last couple of presidential elections were kind of an interesting snapshot of veteran opinion. Trump trounced Hillary Clinton in 2016 among veterans. Biden, 4 years later, narrowed that gap, and I think according to most exit polls and some pre-election polls in 2020, did better than Trump among active duty military personnel, including officers. The trends that we described earlier of all voluntary Army recruitment being concentrated in certain areas of the country, this phenomena of people signing up because they're part of multi-generational military families, I think there's a lot of red state veterans who vote Republican and were enthusiastic Trump supporters. On the other hand, when Bernie Sanders was still an active candidate for the second time for the presidency in 2020, before he was forced to withdraw, he was raising more money in small donations from active duty military personnel than Biden, Trump, and just about everybody else in the field. And I think that's a testament to the fact that even though he's been a longtime critic of Pentagon spending, an opponent of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, he's also had a career-long commitment to veterans issues. He was chair of the Veterans Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. He's been a stalwart defender of the VA and really understood the importance, even as someone opposed to war and militarism, of supporting members of the military and their families and veterans. And I think that was recognized, and that's why he had a surprising amount of support when he ran for president the second time from active duty military personnel.
Suzanne, I'd like to end by asking you how you would like to see the left generally engage with veterans and veterans issues.
Well, I think that there has to be a lot more recognition that veterans are complex, that they don't just represent some Neolithic right-wing bloc. You can talk to veterans. They have a lot of problems as workers, and there are ways to overcome the military-civilian divide, but you have to want to overcome it. And I think, for example, one of the things I've been working on is trying to get supporters of things like Medicare for All to understand how Medicare for All would be beneficial to veterans. I mean, their families would benefit, their communities would benefit. It would help stop the cannibalization of the VA budget, and veterans could to go to whatever kind of provider they wanted. But people in the health reform movement are on one side of this divide, and they tend not to want to talk to vets. They tend to not understand how to rebut right-wing attacks on the VA as a way to tarnish Medicare for All. So if you look at just this one concrete thing, Sasha, you know, that's a place where bridges could be built, but you have to encourage folks who are healthcare reform advocates to know as much about the VA as they do about the Canadian healthcare system, and to understand that veterans are a constituency of consequence. I mean, even though they represent, even though there's only 19 million veterans in America, you know, they have family members, and there's a force multiplier there. I spend most of my time with veterans, and you know, I mean, veterans are like anybody else. You know, they have problems, they have promise. I mean, they're complex. They're not a monolith. And I think that we believe firmly in our writings. And that's why we wrote our veterans. And Jasper Craven, who's our co-author, who's on this, believes the same thing, that, you know, it's really important to have a nuanced understanding of this very important community and to, you know, do more than these lip service, thank you for your service, but to really protect the services that help them. And I think if the left could show that they are interested in veterans' issues by, for example, fighting VA privatization and so forth, I mean, really fighting it, because we need all the help we can get here. I think that that would go a long way to showing, you know, that we really are all in it together, and that this divide should be bridged and can be bridged.
Suzanne, Steve, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Steve Early is writer, organizer, union representative, and labor activist. He is the author of many books, include Save Our Unions and Refinery Town, and he is the co-author with Suzanne Gordon and Jasper Craven of Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs, forthcoming from Duke University Press. Suzanne Gordon is an award-winning author and journalist. Her many books include Wounds of War and The Battle for Veterans Healthcare. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.